Rice, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this October 3rd session, 2022. We have only one matter on our oral calendar today, postponed from previous calendar. City Bella Commercial and Others versus City Bella on Lindale. Council, each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those restrictions. State your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we do keep track of the proceedings in our oral or audio recording of things. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor. I'll just mention this one other thing. You'll notice there's three microphones, and you have your preference. If you like to use the middle microphone, as usual, you certainly may. If you have any concerns about health issues, you're welcome to use the microphone that's closest to your table at your complete discretion.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have the floor when you're ready.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. I'm not used to being here in the afternoon. My name is...
I think I said good morning, so I set you off on the wrong course. Good afternoon. We also aren't used to being here in the afternoon, apparently.
Yeah. My name is Julian Ehrengarten. I'm with Marin Gear. I'm here on behalf of Appellant City Bella on Lindale. And just at the outset, I'd like to thank the panel and opposing counsel. Obviously, we had a series of events that were out of our control, and we appreciate everyone's understanding and flexibility in rescheduling this argument. This is a case about something that never happened. The cooperative's position is that commercial...
What was that?
Well...
My hunch is it's not... I'm not sure, but I'm fairly confident it's probably not respondent's counsel's problem.
Well, fair question, Your Honor.
Would it be fair to say, Ms. Ehrengarten, and I apologize for interrupting you again.
Certainly.
It seemed like even the president of the corporation, the co-op, was not on board when he was deposed either.
That's a fair question, Your Honor. This was sort of a long-standing misunderstanding between these parties. Everybody believed that commercial had been severed from the CIC back, I believe it was in 2004, when the commercial units were deeded to commercial. However, when this issue arose and further investigation was undertaken, the parties discovered, or... You know, the parties discovered that the express steps to achieve severance under MCIOWA, which governs severance of portions of common interest communities such as this, had not been complied with in 2004. The only document that commercial has ever pointed to as even implying a severance is the amended declaration that was filed in 2007. And that document does not expressly sever commercial. It simply, you can read between the lines to understand that at the time that amended declaration was filed, the co-op believed that commercial had been severed. And please keep in mind that at the time the commercial units were deeded away from the CIC, the board that is currently in control of the CIC was not in control of the CIC. It was still under developer control. There, you know, MCIOWA is an extensive statute. There's lots of minutiae in there about how these systems are governed. And until I believe that it says that until a certain percentage of units are sold, the developer retains control. And then after that point, the control is transferred through a series of steps laid out in MCIOWA to the board of the CIC. So at the time these units were deeded out of the CIC, it was still in control of the developer. Then sometime between 2004 when that happened and 2007 when this amended declaration was filed, control was transferred to the board itself. The board, the homeowner volunteer board, had no reason to know or to question that what it was told by the developer about the severance, the deeding out of these units was somehow not in compliance with MCIOWA. The purpose of MCIOWA, of course, is to lay out these detailed requirements to ensure that the homeowners who are members of this community have certain protections in place when they, you know, buy a unit in the building, when they are engaging in determining how to in this case, repair or maintain portions of the building. The idea with MCIOWA is that it protects all homeowners equally.
Ms. Neergaard?
Yes.
Do we even need to get, though, to the issue of whether the strict requirements of the statute, as you point out, are met if, as the district pointed out, and the record seems to support it, they didn't know about it for the 2 years they needed to know about it?
That's a very fair question, Your Honor. Our position is that commercial says they were severed from the CIC. The cooperative, my client, says there's no evidence of severance here. They say the amended declaration shows that we were severed or achieved severance. It's a little unclear. Our position is simply that the amended declaration doesn't say what they, or doesn't achieve what they say it achieves. It's not that we are saying the amended declaration is invalid because it doesn't achieve severance. We are just saying that the language of the amended declaration does not comply with MCIOWA. There's no evidence of the other documents that are required under MCIOWA to achieve severance. And therefore, this argument about the two-year statute of limitations only applies if the challenge is to the validity of the amended declaration. And it's not a challenge to the validity to say that document doesn't do what they say it does. We're not saying that document is invalid. We're saying that document doesn't do what they say it does. And that's different than challenging the validity of the document itself.
Now, if we were to conclude that the document does say what your client would say it doesn't, then the statute of limitations or the statutory deadline would be effective. You essentially would be making a validity argument in that case, correct?
I guess that's a good question. I hadn't particularly thought of it in that light. I think my initial reaction to that is we may have a problem. But again, you know, this is about something that they say happened. They say they were severed. We look at MCIOWA. We look at the requirements under MCIOWA to achieve severance. They include production of certain documents. Those documents include, first, a severance agreement. That agreement needs to approve an amendment to the declaration that complies with MCIOWA. That agreement also needs to authorize the execution and recording of an amended declaration specifying a severance date, allocating assets and liabilities between the association and the severed units, and that agreement also must contain written consent of the holders of the first mortgages on all units that are being severed, and describe in detail the proposed disposition of all real estate to be severed and all assets of the association allocated to the severed units and the distribution of the proceeds of that distribution or disposition, if any. They have not produced any severance agreement. The second document required by MCIOWA is a declaration amendment that legally describes the real estate constituting the remaining common interest community and the property being severed, which this amended declaration does not. That amended declaration must also restate the number of units remaining in the CIC. It must reallocate the interests of the unit owners in the remaining CIC, and it must recite any easements remaining over the severed property. They have not produced any amended declaration that contains all of those required pieces of information. And finally, that amended declaration has to have been filed on or before the purported severance date, because failure to do so, failure to record the amendment before the severance date, voids the severance agreement and the amendment. These are the things that if they were entitled to summary judgment, they could present to the court. They could say, look, We say we were severed. We are the party with the burden to show no genuine issue of material fact. You are required to construe all the evidence in the favor of the opposing party, but we have these documents that comply with this section of MCIOWA, that do all of the things that MCIOWA says we were supposed to do. Here's the documentation that we were severed. They didn't do that, which means that the court is obligated to draw that inference in our favor, to say that the lack of evidence of a severance, the lack of this documentation that complies with MCIOWA, must be construed in the favor of the party opposing that motion, which would be the cooperative.
Nirgaard, I'm still not sure I understand the distinction you make.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at 515B2118, no action to challenge the validity of an amendment or supplemental declaration may be brought more than 2 years after the amendment or supplemental declaration is recorded. Isn't your client, in fact, arguing, and you just did there, that, in fact, they did it wrong? We are questioning the validity of this amendment. What I'm not understanding is when would that, under your interpretation, when would this statute of limitations ever come into play? Because if it was done correctly, of course, and you contested it, it would remain valid. But here your point being is it wasn't done correctly. How does that statute not start to run 2 years after the recording of that amended declaration?
Perhaps it's a nuance that is not... Maybe I'm not articulating it the best way. I hope that I am, but the point we're making is that the only reason this amended declaration is even at issue is because they say, look at this amended declaration that recites a legal description that doesn't include the commercial units. That's their basis for saying we were severed. We say, if you look at what MCIOWA requires, that... just reciting a legal description that excludes portion of the CIC doesn't achieve severance. They were never severed. It's not a matter of they were severed, but we need this amended declaration to be declared invalid to undo that severance. They were never severed in the first place. So
if we take that argument to its logical conclusion,
mm-hmm.
then you would argue that they're also responsible not just for, these charges, part of the $2 million redo, but I assume for all of expenses going back to when the statute should have complied with in the way that you are articulating. Would that be a fair statement?
I think, yes, we could take that position. However, the parties have not reached a point where this has been sorted out, and there are options here, right? We could correct these problems. They could be accepted once again as members with rights in the CIC.
Or they could just pay you the $160 and walk away, too.
Right. Or the parties could actually...
Or your clients could also lose their tax benefits for the last 14 years. Would that be a fair statement?
That's a good question, and I personally don't know.
I'm just going to answer it for your clients. They probably wouldn't, because who wants to go back and amend tax returns for 14 years where you got to pay more money, including interest charges and stuff like that.
Right. So.
The problem I have with that is then they should have been at all these meetings and been able to vote on this stuff, which no one is disputing they were not at any of these meetings, and no one's disputing they ever could have voted. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, because there was a misunderstanding between the parties about the status. However...
Why should we hold this misunderstanding in your favor rather than against you?
Well, so there are a couple of reasons for that. First, you bring
besides
up...
Besides the reasonable, all reasonable inference...
Right, yes.
MCIOWA. I get that. That's fair enough.
So you bring up the tax benefit to the members of the cooperative... my recollection of the district court's order is that the district court judge noted that benefit to the cooperative. I don't recall that the district court noted the converse benefit to commercial, which was that they were not having to share in the overall costs of the maintenance and upkeep of the common elements of this community. You know, they were paying on kind of an ad hoc basis. To the extent that the homeowners received a benefit, commercial also received a benefit in the form of essentially maintaining their own personal space but not having to maintain the building as a whole. I will also point out that this particular project was undertaken because commercial had complained to the cooperative about water intrusion into the commercial units. So this is not a situation where, for example, there was water intrusion into some apartment or some condo unit way far away from commercial, and we're arguing about whether they need to share in the cost for that. This was an issue that was immediately present for commercial, that the co-op had to, its obligation under MCIWA is to fix the problem, to investigate the problem, to allocate the cost, but also the cooperative has a vested interest in not letting the building fall into disrepair. So the cooperative is going to continue to undertake these sorts of ongoing maintenance and repair of the common elements.
How does that fact bear upon our analysis?
Well, it's
a question for us.
It's really a matter of you know, there are, I believe the question was, there's no dispute that they haven't been members of the co-op. There's no dispute that they haven't been voting as part of the co-op. How do we reconcile that with what you're asking us for? I mean, to sort of backtrack on some of what I was talking about, and I can get into more of that if you want, ultimately, the parties have options in this situation. They could actually achieve severance under MCIWA, negotiate a severance agreement, and both walk away from any sort of ongoing need to provide voting shares and to, you know, pay a percentage of the common, of the money for the common upkeep of the building. I see that my time is up. I know that I have more time on rebuttal.
Yes, you
will. And I'd be happy to speak to you more at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mark Vivian, and I represent the respondents. And I'm going to do something that I may regret. I'm going to veer off what I plan to say and address something that opposing counsel said. The statute of limitations argument is dispositive on its own, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I want to address sort of an underlying assumption that I think is incorrect. Opposing counsel seems to suggest that my clients, due to their ownership of the commercial tracts, were, in fact, members of the common interest community. And I want to address a little bit why that's wrong. What evidence could there possibly be that my clients were members of the CIC, or, and importantly in this case, that they ever had any obligation to pay for common expenses? The only thing in the written record, in my view, that could possibly support the notion that the commercial tracts were part of the common interest community is the fact that the legal description of those tracts was included in the original declaration. That's the only thing. Because when you look at the actual language of the documents, and I'll look at the declaration first, and the language is, I believe, identical. This is in paragraph 5 of the declaration. Ownership interests in the cooperative in votes in cooperative matters are hereby allocated to the members occupying each living unit. Not the commercial tracts, the living units. Those are the members of the cooperative. That's what the declaration says, and the amended declaration says the same. When it talks about common expenses, the total common expenses chargeable to members occupying the units in each building, all common expenses of the cooperative in the member share of the master mortgage shall be allocated 85% to building one, which contains 117 units, and 15% to building two, which contains 27 units. And if you look in paragraph 6, those 117 units and 27 are all the residential units. So the document is very clear that not only are my clients not members, it's also clear that all the common expenses are the responsibility of the owners of the living units. So this is not a situation where, gee, we really were members and then something got screwed up. We were never members. What really happened here, and I think the facts make it clear, and Mr. LaMotta was very, I think, candid in his deposition testimony.
Clearly he wasn't prepared. Or chose to be honest.
Chose to be candid.
You know, that's a better way to put it. Chose to be frank.
I'm going to try to introduce that in my own life. I chose to be frank. For more than a decade and almost two, the members of the cooperative believed, in my view correctly, that the commercial tracts were not part of the CIC, and my clients were not members. But when faced with a big bill for a big repair, that position changed. And for the reasons that I'll talk about in a minute in our brief, that change of heart should not be allowed. The commercial tracts were deeded out in 2004 to my clients. And the reason for that is discussed in the briefing, that it allowed the owners of the residential units to claim mortgage interest deductions on their loan payments. In the absence of that, they would not have been able to do that. Obviously, that is important to the members of the cooperative. Because the commercial tracts were removed, the parties, being my client and the cooperative, clients in the cooperative, negotiated access and easement agreements, portions of which talk about sharing of certain expenses and obligations running both ways. None of those agreements, and nobody claims they do, says that my client has any obligation to pay for the plaza repair object, project. But if this had all been taken care of under NCIWA, those outside agreements would not have been necessary. So Mr. LaMotta testified that he believed the conveyance in 2004 took my client's tracts out of the CIC. Any doubt about that, however, was resolved in 2007 when the amended declaration was recorded. Now,
can I clarify, Mr. Vivian?
Yes.
The district court's decision really focused from that time, right? So your earlier comments, while arguably might make a genuine issue of material fact, your client was granted summary judgment because of the amendment and then the 2 years and the statute of limitations and lack of attending meetings, lack of knowledge. And so that's where we should focus.
Oh, I agree. And I didn't mean to suggest that the 2004 events is why we win, Your Honor. 2007 is when the declaration got amended. And the statute of limitation is under 515B2-118, I think it's E, that talks about you cannot challenge the validity of an amended declaration 2 years after its recording.
And can I ask you a follow-up? That seems like the key phrases from these two statutes we're talking about is if the process is not followed, it's void. And then the other is the 2 years to contest. And my question to you is, void to me does connote a legal, in the legal fiction world, it is as if it never happened.
Right.
So if that's true, it never happened, then when would the 2 years, why would the 2 years need to be triggered because, or would be triggered because it just hasn't happened?
Because I think otherwise you could end up a circumstance where you would have here where decades would go by and someone would say, you know what, you didn't do the severance right back in 2007 in this case.
But isn't that true? I'm thinking of that in terms of real estate. Now, this isn't directly our most common, typical situation. The common interest is its own statutory scheme. But we have quiet title actions all the time where both parties understood where the property was and wasn't, or who owned and didn't, and therefore they had to amend the title, or there might be a contest to do that.
Sure.
Why wouldn't that principle apply here, that notwithstanding the co-op's understanding that it had been separated, that it really wasn't as a matter of law because it was void?
Yeah, in Your Honor's comment, it just makes me think, because I do a lot of real estate work, of sort of a reformation action where the parties would say, you know what, we have a document here, but it doesn't really reflect what the parties thought. And the difference in this case, in my view, Your Honor, is that what we have here, what ended up being the case, is exactly what the parties thought. Mr. LaMotta testified candidly, they always believed they weren't members, and my clients always believed they weren't members. So there's not a situation where two people have different views of what was intended, or the document did not reflect what they intended. This document reflects exactly what they intended. So could there be a circumstance where you could go back and look at it again? Sure. This one just isn't it, Your Honor. The amendment of the declaration. Why do we think it affected a severance? So going back to my earlier comments, the only possible thing in the declaration that would suggest that my client's tracts were part of the CIC was the fact their legal descriptions of those tracts were included. Schedule A to the amended declaration removes the legal description of the commercial tracts, which I think are tracts B, C, and D. The only tract that is subject to the CIC on the face of the amended declaration is tract A, which is the living units. So that is why the amended declaration affected the severance. And I think it's important, Your Honor, to address another part of of that statute that talks about the 2-year statute of limitations running from the recording of the document. And we all understand that recording of real estate documents, the reason you record it in the public records is to give notice to the world. And by including that date in the statute, I think the legislature's intent, and it makes sense, is that you're putting everybody on notice that's going to come along later and look at a unit that this property is not part of the CIC because it's not included in the legal description. And because you're looking at recording, you don't end up with discovery rule issues where one party's saying, well, gee, I didn't know that it got severed. Well, we all know it got severed because it got recorded in the public records. That's why we record things. So I think it's important to look at that part of the statute as well. I mentioned this earlier. I'll just touch base on it again briefly. The declaration attributes all the common expenses to the residential living units. It says nothing about my clients paying anything. So even if we were members, we don't have an obligation to pay anything. Now, in response to that, in their brief, they talk about, well, MCIWA doesn't really allow 0% of common expenses to be attributed to the commercial tracts. Well, I disagree with that. In the statute that they refer to for that point is 515B.3-115E. And they say, well, gee, when you read that, it only allows a zero allocation in the context of limited common expense assessments. But if you look at the language that prefaces subsection E, it says, unless otherwise required by the declaration, and then includes a list of circumstances, one of which is cited by opposing counsel in their brief. Here, the declaration did so require. It said residential living units pay everything. That was the provision. So the language of the statute addresses the circumstance or the complaint raised by appellants in this case. On the statute of limitations, and then I'll wrap up. And
therefore, the point being that the resolution doesn't matter if we...
Right.
We rule with the with the appellants or not.
When I look at 515B.3115, you don't have to have, we see really robust declarations typically. And to be honest, the declaration in this case maybe could have been more sophisticated, but you don't have to have a robust declaration. So you can have a declaration that doesn't say all the stuff that most declarations do, and then you look at the default rules in MCIWA. And one of those default rules would be the circumstance that opposing counsel references, but here we have a declaration that explicitly says something different. And in my view, the language, unless otherwise required by the declaration, says you can look at the declaration, you don't have to look at the default rules. Statute of limitations. One argument they make in their brief, in their reply brief, so I don't think we addressed in our briefing, was dealing with the severance. This is really a severance. And they're not really challenging. I guess they did talk about it a little bit today. It's a severance, not an amendment of the declaration, so therefore the validity is not challenged. When you look at the section of MCIWA that deals with severance, which is 515B.2-124D, that section specifically says when you do a severance, you amend the declaration to describe what real estate remains in the CIC. And the amended declaration here does that. As I mentioned earlier, Exhibit A excludes the legal description of the commercial tracts. So the severance mechanism clearly contemplates the recording of an amended declaration. So it would be very odd to suggest that if you have to amend the declaration, that the provision in the section on amendments of declaration regarding a time period doesn't apply. That would make, in my view, very little sense. Now, I will concede, and I think we do this in our papers, there are a whole bunch of hoops to jump through when you do a severance, and they didn't get done. But the amended declaration got recorded, and they had 2 years after that date to challenge it, and they didn't. And for that reason alone, their claims go away. And statute of limitations bar otherwise valid claims all the time. That's one of the parts of statute of limitations, and sometimes it's a harsh result. And sometimes it's not. And in my view, it's not a particularly harsh result here where the residential unit owners gained years of tax benefits as a result of the removal of the commercial tracts. And I agree, I don't think they're going to run out to file a decade of amended returns. And also importantly, the residential unit owners got to run the cooperative as they pleased, with no input or even an ability to vote on the part of my clients. But those benefits came with a cost, and that's the cost that the cooperative is incurring now. Just briefly on the unjust enrichment and equitable claims, I'd really defer to the district court's analysis here. There were express contracts. We've talked about them today. And in that circumstance, there isn't implied or quasi-contractual liability. You look at the documents. And the evidence in the record is that over the years, the parties discussed different or broader cost-sharing arrangements, but those were never entered into. And in my view, the court should not allow the cooperative to achieve through this litigation what they weren't able to achieve through negotiation. So in our view, the judgment should be affirmed. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, that concludes my remarks.
Doesn't appear to be any other questions from the panel members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for Appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, you asked me to identify myself. I'm Julia Nierengarten on behalf of Appellant City Bella.
Thank you.
On Lindale. I made some notes. I may not be particularly in order, but so one of the points that respondent raised in argument, and he kept saying that they were that the original declaration indicates an intention that these commercial units were never part of the CIC. And then he says, but they were deeded out in 2004. If they were never part of the CIC, if they were never part of this overarching system, then why did they need to be specifically deeded out of the CIC by the developer in 2004? I also want to raise the issue of this sort of argument they seem to be putting forth that the mistaken belief of the parties can override the requirements that MCIOA puts in place to actually achieve a severance under the law. There is no exception in MCIOA for a mistaken belief. You know, as Judge Slater mentioned during respondent's argument, you know, mistaken beliefs happen all the time, and that doesn't necessarily change a party's property rights. It requires resolution after time once it's discovered, but you know, there's no exception in MCIOA for a mistaken belief between the parties. And I would say that that should be particularly true where that mistaken belief was based on events that occurred before the homeowners even had control of the cooperative.
You know, I did have one last question, Mr.
Sure.
Garden. So, and this is following up on Judge Sleeter's question to Mr. Vivian. You know, in looking at the district court's opinion on page 5, it specifically says, MCIOA also applies a 2-year statute of limitations to supplemental or amended declarations. No action to challenge the validity of an amendment or a supplemental declaration may be brought more than 2 years after the amendment or supplemental declaration is recorded. Explain to me why this is not precisely what you're trying to do.
Because the challenge is not to the amended declaration. The amended they keep saying that the amended declaration achieves severance. He stood up here and he said, yes, there are all these things that MCIOA requires, and yes, we didn't do any of them, but the conduct of the parties over time, this mistaken belief, something then that results in this amended declaration that in no way complies with MCIOA itself, that document achieves this severance. But that document does not comply. I mean, the MCIOA is a consumer protection statute. The purpose is to protect the homeowners, right? So that they don't get into a situation where, as an example, somebody builds a condominium development, buys the penthouse unit themselves, writes a declaration that says the penthouse unit isn't responsible for any sort of repair or upkeep of the building, and then all of the other owners have to bear the cost of the entire upkeep.
Over the last 14 years, how have the homeowners been damaged in this case?
Well, Commercial has continued to benefit from their exclusive bearing of the cost of the maintenance and the upkeep of the building. But ultimately, and I know I sound like a broken record when I say this, but MCIOWA lays out express requirements to sever. There's nothing in MCIOWA that says we can't look at the evidence after the fact and say, wait a minute. We were all under the belief that you'd been severed, but it's not just a matter of the amended declaration was filed 2 years after the severance date. This is a matter of a complete lack of evidence of compliance with any portion of the severance requirements under MCIOWA. And so the only reason the amended declaration is really at issue is because that's the only thing they can point to that even you could even argue might show a belief that they had been severed. There is no evidence that severance was properly achieved in this case. And absent that evidence.
And of course, your client's deposition.
Well, I mean, I believe his testimony was that they thought it was severed, but that's not, I mean, we don't dispute that we thought they were severed. What we discovered after the fact is that they actually were not severed under MCIOWA. You know, it's, again, this sort of mistaken belief of the parties, but once again, and I know my time is up, there's not an exception in MCIOWA for a mistaken belief of the parties on an issue like this. You know, summary judgment in this case was granted in error. It's our position that Commercial failed to meet its burden to show no genuine issue of material fact and that they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And we would ask that this court reverse the district court summary judgment order and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Neergarden and Mr. Vivian. The matter is taken under advisement, submitted to the court at this time. We appreciate your oral argument, and we too appreciate the agreement by the parties to come and under these circumstances and revisit the case on oral argument. Thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your oral argument today. It's very helpful to the court. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. That's our only